There are people that are afraid to go home. People that are literally starving. People that are dying slowly.
The Rohingya are an ethnic minority that practice Islam that are based on Rakhine State in Myanmar. Beginning in 2012, there was a series of episodes of violence that targeted the Rohingya community.
It's ethnic cleansing, pure and simple. It was the Burmese government. It was the military. And so they would come in and drive the people out.
The military began a very concerted campaign against Rohingya communities that led to the expulsion of about 750,000 or 800,000 Rohingya into Bangladesh, where they've been living in refugee camps.
We went to the Rohingya camp in Cox's Bazar. It's the largest refugee camp in the world. The current conditions are bad. The conditions they're going to experience over the next 3 to 4 months, it's going to be horrendous. The lack of food, cholera, which is already there. They're literally preparing for tens of thousands of people to lose their lives. I visited with one woman who literally watched her entire family hacked to pieces, thrown inside a pit to be burned alive. They tried to kill her as well, and she woke up literally with her family's bodies on top of her, burning. And she was able to crawl out with the little baby and travel through the jungle by herself to get to the refugee camp. Met another young girl who she watched as her dad was shot in front of the wife and kids. She watched her mother's little brothers and sisters be taken. And then she was raped by these 20 men every day, at least 3 times a day by all 20 of them. She lived that way for a week and a half and was able to escape at one point and made it to the refugee camp. But there's a tremendous amount of people that don't even make it.
That was Senior Global Pastor Bob Roberts of Northwood Church in Texas via Skype, and Susan Hayward, Senior Advisor of Religion and Inclusive Studies at the U.S. Institute of Peace, both describing the expulsion of Rohingya Muslims from Myanmar. The government's forced removal and use of torture and rape as a weapon of war has been documented by independent human rights groups as well as the UN's fact-finding mission on Myanmar. This week, Myanmar's de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, stood before the UN International Court of Justice at The Hague to defend her country's political and military leadership from the charges of state-sponsored genocide. Not long ago, Myanmar was hailed for its transition from a military junta to a fledgling democracy. This is Inspired, a production of Interfaith Voices. I'm Amber Khan. This week, we are rebroadcasting our 2018 God and Government special on Myanmar, where we take a closer look at the roots of the violent national identity movement and the links to Buddhism. Myanmar, also known as Burma, is nestled in South Asia between 5 countries, India and Bangladesh to its west, China, Laos, and Thailand to the east. Back in 2015, it seemed the formerly isolated country was headed for a historic opening. Once ruled by a repressive military dictatorship, the Democratic Opposition Party of Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi was elected. There were signs of change. Censorship was abolished. Political prisoners were released. There was a popular assumption and hope that opening its doors to commerce, financial markets, and technology would effectively strengthen the democratic roots being planted. However, today, the country is brutally repressing the religious freedom of ethnic minorities, like the Rohingya. Again, Pastor Bob Roberts.
And you have many of the Buddhist monks that are calling for this. Who would have ever thought that Buddhism would have extremists? But they do, just like any other religion.
We'll learn more about the religious motivations behind Buddhist nationalism later in the show. But first, we take a look at Myanmar's colonial past for clues as to why this is happening. We turn to Harrison Akins, a research fellow at the University of Tennessee's Howard Baker Center for Public Policy.
It was a very prominent and very large historical kingdom in medieval Southeast Asia. And then eventually, through a series of wars with the British armies coming out of British India, beginning in the early 19th century, was eventually absorbed. The kingdom was absorbed in parts into the British Raj. And then eventually gained independence in January 1948. And it's an incredibly diverse ethnically and religiously country. It has 135 recognized ethnic groups within Myanmar, and it has a whole host of religions. It's predominantly a Buddhist country, and I think a lot of the challenges that the country is facing today stem from the conflict and the pursuit of a national identity to develop not just a movement for independence from the British, but a movement to define what this new country is going to be. What does it mean to be a Burmese citizen? How do these ethnic minorities fit into this country?
Aikens explains that many of today's anti-immigrant and anti-ethnic minority sentiments are the result of the British Raj's pursuit of a, quote, divide and rule strategy.
What they were particularly concerned with was the power of the Burmese majority. At the time, it comprised roughly 75% of Burma's population. They were concerned about them being able to form a political alliance to challenge British rule in Burma. And so many of the institutions, the colonial administrative apparatus, was seen to favor minorities within Burma. They recruited them to serve in the military. They recruited them to serve in various civil service positions. And in particular, they sort of denied that same status for the Burman population because they wanted, in essence, to cripple that center of historic political power in Burma. They brought in a lot of laborers, workers from India. Many of them stayed and worked for many, many years and created a lot of resentment by the local population, very much being seen not only as, okay, you are associated with the center of colonial power that's disadvantaging us, but then you're staying here long term. And so they were seen to favor these both immigrant populations coming from India proper today, as well as ethnic minorities within the colony. And then that created a lot of tensions between the majority and the minority.
What were some of the things that you've found in your research that documents or kind of gives evidence to some of the attitudes? Can you give us some examples of how those sentiments were used?
Well, a lot of the sort of rhetoric and sentiments that were being driven, especially in relation to Indian laborers and ethnic minorities, was in the growth of the independence movement in the 1920s, the 1930s, which was very much led by the Burmans. And so this created tensions, especially when the military, which would be composed of minority groups, would be deployed against a lot of these protests that were being pursued by Burmese population. They would oftentimes use slogans that very much differentiated between what was our country, sort of the country for Burmans, and their country, referring to Indian laborers and ethnic minorities, associating them with the colonial power. So they were very much using this kind of rhetoric, not just anti-British rhetoric, but also anti-minority and anti-Indian laborer rhetoric. They wanted to reclaim their country. That really laid the foundations for many of the conflicts that we're seeing today post-independence.
If you're saying it was primarily ethnic divisions, when did the religious become more political?
So you had the early founding fathers of the Burmese state very much asserting this Buddhist identity for the state. The first prime minister, U Nu, supported Buddhism as a state institution. And in particular, what he was trying to pursue was a broader Burmese national identity based in Buddhism. Seeing that, he was very much opposed to minority rights, communal identities that he saw as weakening the nation as a whole. So he thought that by promoting Buddhism as a state institution, this can help the government overcome ethnic divisions within the state and create a stronger national identity. However, Buddhism has also been very much connected to the Burman ethnic identity. And so they've promoted this idea, this very strong idea, in part by opposition to British colonialism and the process of independence, that the only true Burman is an ethnic Burman and a religious Buddhist.
So let's fast forward now. We go through the independence movement. You have this rise in Burman identity, this engagement of Buddhist nationalism as you're describing it. And then there is a shift, there's a change.
The real big change that takes place is in 1962. And that's when the military coup occurs under General Nguyen. And this was in part a response to what they saw as a weak and ineffective government in the face of minority groups who were pursuing greater autonomy, that were pursuing, in some instances, independence from the Burmese state. And this is not unique to Myanmar. Minority groups become scapegoated for the problems of the state. And so a lot of their clamoring for greater rights, greater communal rights, greater recognition of their unique ethnic or, in some instances, religious identity was seen as the great challenge to Myanmar. It was seen as something that weakens the state. And it was this idea that informed a lot of their policies that would come after their rule, especially as they began to set up a more institutionalized system that was meant to, in essence, purify the state.
Well, let me pause right there. When you use that kind of language, purify the state, and you talk about policies, it echoes a lot of the things that we're reading in terms of what's happening today. Right. What were the policies that they were putting into place?
They wanted to get rid of not just symbols, but also people that were associated with colonial rule. And so in the beginning of the late 1970s in particular, they implemented a military operation called Naga Men. And the purpose was to, through violence, through very coercive military operations, push the Rohingya population and other populations associated with colonial rule out of the country. There was a border security force that they started in the early 1990s called NASAKA, and they were in particular singled out as some of the worst perpetrators of systematic rape, targeting of civilians amongst the Rohingya population. But because of criticism internationally, that the NASAKA was eventually disbanded in 2013. So what you're seeing today against the Rohingya with the military operations, the mass exodus, this is a long pattern that dates back decades. And so many of the early military operations by the government specifically targeted the Rohingya, not Muslims writ large, but the Rohingya. And their argument was that they were not Rohingya. There is no Rohingya ethnic group. The 1982 citizenship law denied them basically their identity and said they are not part of the 135 officially recognized ethnic groups, denied them citizenship. And the argument was is that they were illegal Bengali immigrants that came under British rule. So they have no right to residence in Burma.
How did the religious leadership, the monks, react to these military operations?
Well, I think that's, in my opinion, one of the more shocking. In terms of the complicity and support of the broader population, the role of Buddhist religious leadership. There is a famous movement that emerged after the liberalization that began in 2002 called the 969 Movement. One of their movements was to target, to boycott any shops that were owned by Muslims.
Regardless of ethnicity.
The violence against Muslims that were originally directed specifically to the Rohingya, beginning after 2010, began to touch all the Muslim communities. And so a lot of these protests, some mob attacks, have targeted Muslims all over the country as well. That was led by, in particular, one monk named Uratu. And he has really advocated and pushed for policies that target the Muslims as not belonging in the state. And he used the metaphor in one famous interview with Time magazine a few years ago. He said that the Muslims today are like a seed. And if you plant the seed in a pagoda, right now it's not a problem. But eventually that seed will grow into a tree and will destroy the pagoda. So you have to remove that seed now before it destroys it. And he used that metaphor to describe how the government should be treating the Muslims in Myanmar today. Buddhism is, like I think all religions, it's a religion of peace. And so we should understand this as an aberration. These are it's a fundamentalist movement within Buddhism that is very much being influenced by the politics and the social context that they're interacting with.
That was Harrison Akins, a research fellow at the University of Tennessee's Howard Baker Center for Public Policy. We're going to hear an on-the-ground report about the challenges facing Muslims across Myanmar, including non-Rohingyas, after a break. But first, Akins has one last point. Myanmar's recent democratization has meant increased religious freedom, but only for the majority population.
So a lot of the policies of the government, especially because the military still plays a really important role as a political actor in Myanmar, a lot of that democratization is not filtered down into rights for minorities. As there was this opening up of press freedom, of civil society, there's also more freedom to organize, more freedom for political expression. And what happened was a lot of these Buddhist nationalist movements began to express themselves in the public civil space. They began to very much crowd out other opinions. And the government, they saw that as basically in step with what they wanted the government policies to be towards minorities. So while, yes, democratization can lead to greater civil and political rights, you still have to deal with that idea that minorities don't have the same representation in the centers of power that the majority population does.
This is Inspired, a production of Interfaith Voices. Hi, friends. This is Amber. I hope you're enjoying the show. Every week, we work to bring you a program that will not only educate, but also illuminate the world around us, bringing you voices and stories from all corners of the globe that explore how beliefs are shaping our world. Now, I want to just take a moment here and ask you to consider how much you value us. Because we are,
most of our listeners
don't realize, we don't receive any funding or support from NPR or the member stations that carry us. And so I'd like to ask you to consider making a donation, especially during this season of giving. As we approach our end of year and our budgeting for 2020, we want to make sure we can continue to bring you the high quality reporting that you've come to count on. Please visit interfaithradio.networkforgood.com. Take care and have a wonderful week.